Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I got to sit down with Renato Mariotti, who is a former federal prosecutor and current CNN analyst. He's also been on the show before, I believe back in December, and I had a bunch of questions to ask him about the Michael Cohen tapes and then also the declassification of FISA documents related to Carter Page.
Sort of a legal doctrine where you can't selectively waive privilege in order to use privilege as a sword and not a shield is kind of the way it's described. In other words, yeah, the point of privilege is to protect you, not so you can say, well, you know what, this is the one good conversation we have, so we're going to waive privilege on that one, and then the bad conversations we're going to hold back. So typically lawyers are very careful about waiving privilege.
As like last time he was on, he offered some very insightful and incisive analysis of what exactly is going the fuck on. We talked a little bit about language, especially surrounding the legal mess surrounding Trump and Trump's associates. And it was a very fascinating. He is very smart and very easy to talk to. So it really is a great interview. Before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit very briefly about two news stories that I think are important and related and really talk about gaslighting. So the first one is if you remember, Trump and Putin gave a joint press conference, and one reporter asked Putin if he wanted Donald Trump to win and if he had put any resources to helping Trump win the election. And Putin said, yes, I did, because some bullshit reason he likes Russia, he wants better relation, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so in the White House's official transcript and official video of that press conference, they had very skillfully cut out that question. So think about this. We know that it happened. It happened live on TV, on the radio. It happened live. This question was asked. It was answered by Putin. The White House then turns around and cuts that out and is now trying to say that it never happened. And this is obviously a pattern with the Trump administration. This is obviously a theme, and this is how it operates. But this is such an egregious example of that. I mean, it's so blatant. It's cutting out a question asked at a press conference. It's removing it from the transcript and the video and the audio. I'm actually speechless. This didn't surprise me. Just like I said on Monday's episode, this is the conclusion we've always been hurtling towards, especially women like Sarah Kendzior have been saying that since forever. But it kind of floored me, because there the very 1984-esque, the Orwellian, the authoritarian idea of don't believe your eyes and ears, believe me. And the, I guess, guts or gall that it took to so clearly manipulate the American people is amazing. I think that a really important aspect of this show is to keep reminding everyone that this is A, not normal, B, this is not how democracies operate, and C, this is actually happening. And this sort of gaslighting at this level is going on. Russia, by the way, Russian media also cut out the question and the answer, which, I mean, that's what Russia does. Russia has state-run media. That's we understand that to be true in Russia, but we're not Russia. We don't want to be Russia. Or I guess Trump wants us to be Russia, but we're not. So that is just absolutely bananas is not a strong enough word. And so kind of on this vein of gaslighting, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, sat down with the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday and gave hours of testimony on what the fuck happened in the one-on-one Trump-Putin meeting. And he basically just avoided questions and completely obfuscated any sort of truth. So the questions were on the vein of, did Trump tell you what he talked about with Putin in that one-on-one meeting? And Pompeo kept saying over and over and over that basically they talked about the U.S.'s strong position on Russia and Russian interference, and just kept pointing to these policies. And he was saying that Trump doesn't have to have strong rhetoric on Russia. It just has to have these strong actions. And it's the actions and the policies that speak for themselves, and that what the president is saying doesn't really matter. And that is a load of horseshit. Because here's the thing. Policy speaking for themselves only works when it's just the policy. It needs to be a standalone issue with no other commentary around it from people like the president. I mean, the problem here is that the president's power of the pulpit lends itself to making policy on the fly, which is why most every president before him didn't speak on an issue until they've thought this shit through. And if they did, it was considered a major gaffe. And Trump just goes on Twitter whenever he's taking a crap and says the first thing that comes to his head. And that's how we get these fucked up policies like kicking transgender service members out of the armed services, which was something Trump just tweeted and then had his administration create policy around it. And that's not how policy is made. And that's why Trump's actions versus Trump's rhetoric is so important. Because the rhetoric of Trump is, first of all, in direct contradiction with the rhetoric of the Trump administration and Trump policies. But when it comes to the American people, when it comes to our political system, the default is to, when those things are in contradiction, when the president is saying one thing as administration is saying the other, we assume what the president is saying is the correct statement. So that's always been the precedent. And so for Mike Pompeo to sit in the Senate and say, oh no, the policies speak for themselves, who cares what Trump is saying? I mean, that's kind of a load of shit. Like, I don't care what Trump is saying. I think his Twitter feed is just one continuous pile of bullshit. But the fact of the matter is that for most people, that is the word of the president and by extension of his administration. And policies BM. No one's sitting there reading complicated policy documents. They're going off of what they hear in the media. And what they're hearing in the media is from Trump directly because this asshole uses Twitter like a 14-year-old girl sending flirty messages to her crush. I mean, it's fucking ridiculous. So I just, again, want to say that something that Rachel Maddow says all the time, and I feel like I talk about Rachel Maddow all the time, but, you know, look at what this administration is doing, not what they're saying. And that is definitely important because they gaslight us, because they put out scrub transcripts that don't make any sense with what actually happened. Because that's the case, we cannot look at what they're saying. We have to look at the actions because we cannot trust the statements and the documents that this White House is putting out. But what we need to remember is that what our leaders say is important, and that historically, what the president has said has been law. And so when we have a policy in place, but the president directly contradicts it in what he's saying, then the default is to side with the president. So Pompeo is full of shit because he can say the policies speak for themselves and it doesn't matter what they talked about. And he can, you know, dodge all these questions all he wants. But that doesn't change the fact that the president's words are dictating actions. And his words are being soft on Russia, are agreeing with Putin, and are basically admiring an authoritarian regime that he would like to implement in the United States. I also want to take a quick second to talk a little bit about these Michael Cohen tapes that I talk about with Renato in the interview. And there's something that I was trying to figure out a way to ask him, though it didn't really connect, so it didn't make it into the interview. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the women in this story, because we're talking a lot about these tapes. And obviously these tapes are, you know, people, the intrigue point, right? People want to know the legal exposure, the legal liability, what it means for Cohen, what it means for Trump. Was there election campaign finance violations? Is this illegal? Ethical problems? And that's all fine. But what I feel like we lose when we talk about it in that way is we lose the fact that there are at least three women involved in this story directly. There's Karen McDougal, there's Stormy Daniels, and as an aside to those two, I'll say there are probably many, many other women who have been through this similar process with Trump and his cronies and Cohen. And then there's Melania Trump. And I'm not one to sit here and defend Melania Trump, and I'm not going to. But what I will say is that in the case of these women and all of the unnamed women who have gone through this process, is that they have been made objects, not actors, in this story. This is something that happened to them too, and we often leave that out of the narrative. And I'm not saying that they did anything wrong. What I'm saying is that we need to remember that they are people who are also affected by this, and this is just emblematic of the systemic objectification of women, that when we talk about news stories that include women, we don't include them in the actual story. So, like I said, they've become objects, not actors, in this story, and I think we need to keep that at top of mind. Again, I'm not saying they did anything wrong or that we should invade their privacy, but I am saying that they are part of this, and we should really take that to heart. I'm going to remake a confession. I record most of these shows in my PJs. It's one of the main perks of working from home. So when I learned that Tommy John, a revolutionary men's underwear company, was launching a women's line, I was really excited. Their underwear and camisoles are so soft and comfortable that I have replaced almost all of my undies with their new women's gear. And their t-shirts and pajama pants are my go-to for recording days. Y'all know so much about me now. Tommy John quality fabrics and innovative and intuitive designs are a testament to their commitment to providing mind-blowing comfort. They are so fucking comfortable. I cannot tell you how good they are. And they also have the best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. If Tommy John isn't the most comfortable underwear you've ever worn, Tommy John will pick up the tab. They've sold more than 5 million pairs of underwear, and hopefully Michael Cohen has heard of them because he's going to shit his pants once the Southern District of New York is done with him. So hurry to TommyJohn.com/Hellbent for 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/Hellbent for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/Hellbent. Michael Cohen, hurry over. You're going to need the discount. Okay, I now have the pleasure to introduce the Hellion of the Week. And we actually have two this week. I couldn't choose between these two stories, so we're going to do both. The first one was a woman running for Congress in Massachusetts named Barbara Letalian. So Barbara Letalian was accidentally booked on Fox and Friends. They thought that they were booking Ann Kirkpatrick, who is the only Democrat that supports ICE, at least according to Fox and Friends. But they fucked up and they contacted Barbara Letalian's people. So instead of telling them that they made a mistake, she went on live television on Fox and Friends and said, "I'm speaking directly to Donald Trump, and what you're doing at the border is disgusting, and we need to stop abducting children." And Fox and Friends hosts made some feeble attempts to be like, "That's not happening anymore, and you don't know what you're talking about." And she just kept repeating herself over and over until they cut her off. So I just want to say, that is a fucking hellion, where you just go in, guns blazing, and give zero fucks. And she managed to get this very important message across, and I am so grateful to her. The second one is a girl. Her name is Julianne Spire, and she is 12, and she is from Russell Township. So she wrote a letter to the editor that they published about the 4th of July parade in her city. I'm going to read the whole thing because you just have to hear it from her, a 12-year-old. I was not this articulate at 12. Quote, "My name is Julianne Spire. I am 12 years old, and I would like to inform you of how offended and disappointed I am by the announcer of the Chesterland 4th of July parade's comment about the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. The announcer labeled the Boy Scouts as, quote, future leaders of America, and he said the Girl Scouts were, quote, just having fun. I found this comment very sexist and patronizing. I would appreciate it if you would help me to let other people know how much this kind of thing happens and how bad it is. I feel it is an insult to both girls and women of all ages. This kind of thing happens way too much and is not okay at all. I have always been taught that if you think something is unjust, change it. So this is how I am making a change. Thank you for listening to me, and I hope you can help me." Girl, get it. I'm sorry. That was the most amazing thing I've ever seen written by a 12-year-old. And I think everyone knows by now that I was a Girl Scout until I graduated high school. I'm very into the Girl Scouts. Also, Hillary Clinton was a Girl Scout. Michelle Obama was a Girl Scout. So to say that they're just having fun and that Boy Scouts are future leaders of America is 1,000% grade A bullshit. So calling out like this is such an important part of changing the way we see women and girls. And it really takes girls like Julianne Spire to stand up and have that courage. And for us as a society to give her that courage. And our role in this is to take these girls and lift them up, because they are our future leaders. Boy Scouts be damned. Girl Scouts are the future leaders of America. And for her to say that out loud and proud just warms my cold feminist heart. So Julianne, thank you so much, and continue with Girl Scouts as long as you can, and I know you're going to change the world. Our guest today is Renato Mariotti. He's a former federal prosecutor and current CNN analyst. He offers sharp legal analysis on Twitter and is frequently a voice of reason on complicated legal and political matters. Thank you so much for being on today.
You're welcome.
And I also heard that you are working on your own podcast. Can you tell us any details about that?
Well, it is coming out in the next month or so. We've been working hard to develop it. I'm going to be breaking down complex topics, often legal topics, on the podcast, a different topic every week. And my co-host is my friend Patty Vasquez, who's a radio host here in Chicago and is going to, kind of play the role of the person in the audience who doesn't understand these topics. So the two of us, I think, have a good energy, and I'm really excited about getting it started. Just, you know, to be able to pick topics and go in depth in them on CNN, a lot of times I'm, you know, very limited in the amount of time that I have.
Right, right. Yeah. So Patty Vasquez plays me on this podcast because I always need help understanding this stuff. That's great. Does it have a title?
We're working on that. So if people have suggestions, they can reach out to me.
Oh, okay. All right. That's good to know. So I want to jump in and talk about Michael Cohen. He's been in the news a lot, obviously. But just recently, it came to light that he recorded several conversations between himself and Trump. And one of the conversations has been, there's a transcript of it, and I believe it's been talked about in the media. So it's about the possible $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal by Trump to cover up his affair. So does this represent legal liability for Cohen?
So not in and of itself. Making the recording is not illegal. Okay. He was in New York. So in New York, as long as you want to, if you're part of a conversation, not overhearing something, but if you're part of the conversation and you want to tape it, you can. There is potential ethical problems for Cohen because he's an attorney. So, you know, to the extent that Trump is his client or was his client, you have a duty of confidentiality as a lawyer. And, you know, it's not 100% crystal clear whether the mere taping of your client violates that duty, but it's certainly very careless. It's a sort of thing that I suspect a bar association would not like. But, you know, remember, Cohen is facing very, very serious charges that he's under investigation for by federal prosecutors in Manhattan. So really ethical problems and, you know, bar association problems are kind of the least of his worries.
Right. Does it relate to the fact that the court-appointed special master found that the documents taken in the search of his office and residences were considered to be not privileged? Does that change the privileged status of this conversation?
So, you know, it's actually really interesting. You know, there are reasons why a conversation like this might not be privileged. If, for example, it's not regarding the seeking of legal advice, or it is carrying forward a fraud or a crime in some way. But actually, there's been some subsequent reporting that, in fact, the special master, who's like a retired judge that the judge in the New York case appointed to look at these privilege issues, that she actually found that this was a privileged conversation initially, and then that the objection to its release was withdrawn by the Trump team. And it's a very odd development, and it's a legal strategy that's hard to understand. So one thing that may not be apparent to people who aren't lawyers is that lawyers are generally very, very wary of waiving privilege. And part of that's because obviously, you know, once you waive it, you can't unwaive it, you know, and so that's the first thing. Second of all, sometimes when you waive privilege on one conversation, you can end up having privilege waived on other conversations or other documents, for example, that are totally separate and apart from that one. And the reason why is there's a sort of a legal doctrine where you can't selectively waive privilege in order to use privilege as a sword and not a shield, kind of the way it's described. In other words, yeah, the point of privilege is to protect you, not so you can say, well, you know what, this is the one good conversation we have, so we're going to waive privilege on that one, and then the bad conversations we're going to hold back. So typically lawyers are very careful about waiving privilege. So I saw my friend Jill Weinbanks, who is a commentator on MSNBC, today for lunch, and she was asking me, "Can you make any sense of this strategy?" And it puzzled her as well. And I said to her, "Honestly, I can't." So it certainly doesn't make sense as a legal strategy to waive privilege.
Right. Yeah, that was one of my next questions, was why waive this privilege? There's even a theory that I've heard that the Trump team, legal team, may have leaked this conversation themselves. And that just doesn't make a ton of sense to me, especially this conversation opened Trump up to legal exposure.
So what I would say, first of all, is, you know, this isn't the first thing that the Trump team has done that makes no sense. Okay, so
right,
I
right.
mean,
that's fair.
Okay, who knows? They could be irrational. What I would say, separate and apart from that, though, is there could be PR reasons, you know, or political reasons that are separate and apart from legal strategy. So, for example, maybe they didn't want to be in the situation of asserting that Cohen was their lawyer. Maybe they were concerned about how it would appear if they were there was these conversations that weren't released. You know, I don't know. You know, in other words, they could have felt that the conversations, when you actually hear them, are not as bad as what people would imagine they would be if they were protected by privilege,
right.
Something like that. But, you know, most lawyers would not have made the decision that they made. Very unusual.
Right. Well, and Rudy Giuliani actually said that this tape does not look bad for Trump and that it is actually, quote, powerful exculpatory evidence. So I have two questions. One, can you explain what exculpatory evidence is to me? Because I'm not sure I understand the term, especially the term in this context.
Sure. So exculpatory evidence is evidence that tends to show that the person is not guilty of a crime. And so exculpatory evidence is a very important concept in criminal law. The government, for example, is required to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense. So, for example,
right.
if there's someone else's DNA on the murder weapon, you know, that's exculpatory evidence. I think that it's a stretch to call a conversation like this exculpatory evidence. It may not be incriminating, although there have been other people other than Giuliani who have listened to the call who told CNN and other outlets that it, in fact, was problematic for Trump. You know, what I would say is sort of as a general rule, without knowing what's in the conversation, you know, whenever you or your client are caught on tape talking to a suspected criminal about the topics under that they're under investigation for, that's not a good thing. Period. And so it's just I mean, however you want to slice it, it's not a great thing for Trump. I mean, I think you would rather not have the recording.
Right, right. I also want to talk about something a little more general about the Michael Cohen case. And that was when the search warrant was executed on Michael Cohen's office and residences.
Mm-hmm.
It was Trump said that, you know, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but that attorney-client privilege is dead and that mm-hmm. the FBI had raided his offices. And I want to talk about language a little bit for a second. I feel like this is really important because this is a search warrant that was executed in the course of a, you know, investigation. So is calling it a raid really, I mean, I feel like that's very inflammatory for what this was. Was it a raid or was it, I don't know, that term has always felt odd to me.
Well, that's a really, really sophisticated question on your part. So the term raid is used a lot by the media to discuss the execution of search warrants. If you look at my Twitter feed or my op-eds that I write or any of my other writings, I never use the term raid because, like you, I think, you know, to me, it's like the Vikings are coming and pillaging your right your place. It's not what law enforcement's doing. And that in a circumstance where law enforcement, and this is typically what it is, they go to a federal judge, they present evidence, they get a warrant, they show up with a warrant. To me, that's not really a raid. I mean, that is them executing a search warrant in a lawful way. And they're doing what the Constitution expects them to do, what we as citizens would want them to do. So I don't view it that way at all. You know, as for the rhetoric coming from Trump, you know, what I would say there is just that, you know, search warrants of attorney offices are something that the Justice Department takes very seriously, that they have special procedures for, require special approvals for, and are not done frequently. Now, they are done on a regular basis, because there are just enough federal prosecutors out there and enough corrupt attorneys that, you know, every year, I'm sure, attorneys' offices are getting searched, but they are, you know, a rare thing. So during my time as a federal prosecutor in Chicago for about a decade, I was a federal prosecutor for almost a decade. You know, there was only a few instances that I remember where an attorney's office was searched. And so, you know, that, and that's a very, very large office. So it gives you a sense of the fact that it's something that there is precedent for, but it's done infrequently.
So kind of on that theme of infrequently, I want to also talk about the FISA documents that were declassified a couple of days ago and released, or I guess the FISA documents themselves were declassified several months ago when we had those dueling Republican and Democratic memos back in February. But then the DOJ actually released the documents just a few days ago. So I guess from my understanding, it's exceedingly rare to declassify FISA documents of any kind. So what the hell is going on? What from a political standpoint, to what end are these documents being released?
Yeah, I will say that I would go beyond what you said. I think it's pretty much unprecedented for FISA applications and warrants to be declassified and released in the way that these are. I can't think of off the top of my head another instance in which it happened. Perhaps there is, and I don't remember, but it's very, very rare. The head of FISA under the George W. Bush administration, you know, tweeted out, you know, what a disaster that was for national security. From her perspective, you know, she believed that it was, you know, that the release of these documents endangered our country. I'm not in a position to evaluate that, but I will say that a lot of national security folks who frequently use FISA or interact with the FISA court were very disturbed by the release of the documents. And I think, and I heard one commentator say that even if you're critical of FISA, and there's a lot of principled people who are, particularly people on the left and also libertarians who are kind of, whether you call them in the right or in the middle, you know, people who think that the whole idea of FISA is problematic. You know, I heard one commentator say that even if you're one of those people, this is not the right first case. This is not the right case to be using to be challenging the FISA court. You know, the release here was highly politicized. You know, it was done in order to further, you know, false and misleading arguments against the, you know, Mueller and Russia investigations. And, you know, what the documents show is essentially, you know, very standard warrants and a very boring process in which two different presidential administrations presented, you know, a lot of evidence to four different judges who all found that Carter Page was an agent of the Russian government.
Well, and I mean, looking at the released documents, I mean, they're all well over 80 pages apiece. I mean, they're very detailed and, like you said, very dry and sort of regular. So, and the New York Times actually said that these documents showed, I mean, basically that, yes, Carter Page is a, you know, kind of working with as a Russian agent, and that Page has been part of Trump's campaign. Isn't that bad for Trump? I guess I'm still just extremely confused as to what these documents are supposed to be showing.
Yeah, I mean, what the documents show when you read them is that the Obama administration and the Trump administration, Justice Department, you know, FBI folks in both administrations determined that Carter Page was an agent of a foreign government. And just to be crystal clear so the listeners understand, FISA warrants are – it's a special type of warrant that the government can get for counterintelligence investigations to listen to people who are agents of foreign governments. They're different than the type of wiretaps that I used to get when I was investigating federal crimes, where I was wiretapping people who are suspected criminals. That's a very different thing. I was trying to show that there is probable cause, in other words, a good reason to believe that people committed crimes. Here they're trying to show that there's a good reason to believe that Carter Page was an agent of the Russian government. And so the whole application is trying to show that, and ultimately that's the conclusion that all four of those FISA applications Which were made both under the Obama and Trump administration showed, and then ultimately four federal judges signed off on each one. Federal judges signed off on all four of the applications. And there's no real way to spin that as helping Trump. To me, what they show is, first of all, that Carter Page, there was very significant and legitimate concerns about Carter Page. And second of all, that Devin Nunes was trying to deceive everyone when he raises concerns in his memo.
The weird, undercover press conference is still one of, I consider, the most bizarre moments of 2017.
For sure.
Yeah. And then also, I know that this shouldn't matter, but four out of four of the federal judges that signed off on these warrants were appointed by Republican presidents. So this isn't even necessarily a partisanship issue as much as it is a legal issue.
That's right. I don't bring that up because I don't think it should matter, but they were all appointed by Republicans. The judges on the FISA court tend to be Republicans. Chief Justice Roberts tends to appoint Republicans to that court. And, I actually think that there's nothing very remarkable about these applications and warrants other than the fact that it's been very politicized and so on. I mean, when you read them, there's nothing really that crazy about them.
Releasing them has only damaged the sort of reputation of the FISA court as a sort of lockbox of national security.
I think it certainly would make folks in the intelligence community wonder that if they put something in a FISA application, whether it would be released. I think in addition, it gives the public and our adversaries a sense of how our FISA system works. And, I think that's, something that perhaps foreign policy professionals are concerned about adversaries knowing. I think that the concern that I have with this is just that there was really no there with this investigation. But then when I say this investigation, I mean the Nunes congressional investigation into the FISA issues that they are claiming were evidence of bias or wrongdoing by the FBI and DOJ. They literally misrepresented the source documents, which we now can see ourselves, and they essentially created a lot of false narratives and false headlines and wasted a lot of time and generated these disclosures for nothing. And it's just disappointing, and it's a really sad thing for our country.
Well, on that extremely depressing note, I want to just thank you again for taking time to speak with me and illuminating basic legal concepts like exculpatory evidence. I'm sure that your podcast will be very helpful on those matters.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So you can follow Renato at Renato_Mariotti. And like I said, he'll be releasing details on his new podcast soon. So thank you again, Renato.
Thank you so much, Devin. Anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Hellions, that is it for me. Varsha and I will be back here on Monday. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and remember to raise some hell and be compassionate. I'll see you on Monday.